This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
This is the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, Dana Augusta reporting. And this is something new that we're doing here on the podcast. In addition to what we do here on the regular, we're going to give you short episodes, or at least that's the plan, give you short episodes where we're going to celebrate sports headlines and other meaningful events that happened this particular week in sports history. And as usual, please feel free to check out our social media presence on many different platforms to get your daily fix of sports history. In this episode, we're going to talk about some of the events and memorable moments from the week of March the 30th through April 5th. Since we are in the middle of March Madness, most of the things that we're going to talk about happen on the collegiate court. Yet there are several other notable events in sports that took place this week, including a pair of significant upsets in the world of boxing. We're going to start off with, of course, college basketball, which is the sporting event taking place that has the nation's attention right now. So with that being said, this week in 1991 featured one of the most memorable Final Fours ever that included the birth of a college basketball power and an upset of a team that was looking to go undefeated for the first time since 1976. Dateline, Indianapolis, the Hoosier Dome. This week in 1991, all roads of the NCAA basketball tournament led to the Hoosier Dome for the first time. That year, the four teams that remained standing in after the dust had settled was North Carolina, coached by Dean Smith and led by the likes of Pete Chilcutt, George Lynch, Rick Fox, and current Tar Heels head coach Hubert Davis. Their opponents in the national semifinal was Kansas, coached by a very familiar face to North Carolina, former Dean Smith assistant coach Roy Williams, who was in his third year in Lawrence. In the first national semifinal, Kansas, led by Adonis Jordan and Mark Randall, 16 points each, had defeated the Tar Heels 79-73 to advance to the national championship game for the first time since winning it all in 1988. Yet the headline event was the other semifinal between overall number one team in the tournament and the defending national champion University of Nevada, Las Vegas Running Rebels, taking on the Duke Blue Devils. Now, those two teams had played the year before for the national championship game with UNLV winning in a blowout for their first ever national championship. This time, the Rebels returned with essentially the same squad, this time on a 45-game winning streak and the National Player of the Year, Larry Johnson. Yet, UNLV were on the quest to not only win their second consecutive national championship, but also looking to become the first team since Indiana in 1976 to go undefeated. Meanwhile, Duke, who were becoming a national power, had still yet to win a national championship under head coach Mike Krzyzewski. Duke, of course, was led by point guard Bobby Hurley, center Christian Laettner, and forward Grant Hill. Now, Duke started the game on fire, hitting their first five shots of the game to sprint out to an early 13-5 lead. But the Rebels, led by Larry Johnson, Stacey Augman, and Anderson Hunt, caught up and entered halftime holding a slim 43-41 lead. The game became a seesaw battle throughout most of the second half, yet the key moment of the game happened with less than 4 minutes to go, when UNLV point guard and future NBA star Greg Anthony was called for an offensive foul, which was his fifth, fouling him out of the game, and the Rebels would be without their most experienced ball handler. Yet despite this, UNLV went on a 6-0 run to hold a 76-71 lead with just 2.5 minutes left. Yet Duke would get within 2 points on a Bobby Hurley three-pointer, then after a UNLV shot clock violation, Duke would take the lead when Brian Davis hit a driving layup and was fouled by Larry Johnson. After the made free throw, Duke had led 77-76 with about a minute left in regulation. The Rebels would tie the game at 77 as Larry Johnson hit one of two from the line, and then on the ensuing possession, Leitner was fouled and was sent to the line for two shots with 12.7 seconds left. Leitner calmly hit the free throws to give the Devils a 2-point lead. Then, in the words of Marv Albert, "It had now come down to this." On UNLV's final possession, Larry Johnson brought the ball up and for a split second thought of shooting it, but instead passed it to guard Anderson Hunt, who finished that game with a game-high 29 points. He got the ball at the top of the three-point arc. However, Hunt's desperate three-pointer over both Hurley and Leitner was off target, and the Blue Devils hung on to the 79-77 win, considered by many as one of the greatest upsets in Final Four history. Leitner finished with 28 points and led the Blue Devils, while Bobby Hurley recorded 7 assists. 2 days later, Duke would win their first ever national championship, this against Roy Williams and the Kansas Jayhawks, 72-65. Leitner was named Tournament Most Outstanding Player, scoring 18 points in the title game. Duke would go on to become the first team since the days of the UCLA dynasty in the early to mid-1970s to win consecutive national championships, as they repeated as champs in 1992. But the national semifinal game between Duke and UNLV will continue to live on as one of the greatest basketball games ever. If you look at the calendar through the lens of sports history, you'll notice there's a lot of great and legendary moments in the world of college basketball. And needless to say that this is personally one of my favorite times of the year on the sports calendar. So let's continue with some more great moments in college basketball that took place this week in sports history. Dateline, San Diego, California. This week in 1975, UCLA's legendary coach John Wooden had made it clear that this was going to be his final year as coach and will be retiring at the end of the tournament, win or lose. At this point, the Bruins had won 9 national championships in the space of 11 years, and the Bruins players, led by Marcus Johnson and future Tournament Most Outstanding Player Richard Washington, wanted to send the great Wizard of Westwood out on top. In the national semifinal played at the San Diego Sports Arena, the Bruins edged former UCLA assistant coach Denny Crum and his Louisville Cardinals 75-74 when Richard Washington sank a baseline jumper in the final seconds to give the Bruins a 1-point win. Moving on to the championship game, UCLA had knocked off Kentucky 92-85 for the Bruins' 10th national championship and indeed sent John Wooden off as a winner once again. Interesting side note to this Final Four was, with UCLA winning the title in San Diego, this marked the last time a team had won the national championship playing in his home state. I found that very hard to believe, very interesting, but it is also very true. Now fast forward 20 years. This time in Seattle in the 1995 Final Four, this also happening this week in sports history. With John Wooden sitting in the stands this time at the Seattle Kingdom, the UCLA Bruins would once again claim a national championship. After beating Bryant, Big Country Reeves, and the Oklahoma State Cowboys, in the national semifinal, the Bruins would face off against the defending national champion Arkansas Razorbacks. The Bruins, this time led by coach Jim Herrick and Tournament Most Outstanding Player Ed O'Bannon, the Bruins claimed the school's 11th national championship by beating Arkansas 89-78 as O'Bannon finished with 30 points. Dateline, Albuquerque, New Mexico. This week in 1983, and perhaps one of the greatest finishes in NCAA tournament history, as well as one of the biggest upsets ever, North Carolina State, led by head coach Jim Survive and Advance Valvano, led his Wolfpack to the national championship against the world's first dunking fraternity known as Phi Slamma Jamma from the University of Houston. The Houston Cougars, coached by Guy Lewis and was led by the athletic Clyde Drexler, my all-time favorite player by the way, They also had Nigerian center Akeem Olajuwon and equally athletically talented Benny Anders on the squad. And after beating Louisville, known as the Doctors of Dunk, in the national semifinal, Houston was an overwhelming favorite to beat North Carolina State. In a game that was close throughout, it came down to the final possession for North Carolina State. And after a couple of near steals by Drexler, North Carolina State guard Derek Wittenberg hoisted a desperation three-pointer in the final seconds. The shot was off the mark, but NC State's Lorenzo Charles caught the ball and jammed it through as the clock went to zero as the Pack claimed their second national championship, upsetting Houston 54-52 in perhaps one of the most improbable finishes in the history of basketball. The most indelible moment from this game, of course, was at the end when Jimmy V was running around the court looking for someone to hug in all the excitement. One of the great moments of March Madness. Next, Dateline, Lexington, Kentucky. In an equally shocking upset just 2 years later, the defending national champion Georgetown Hoyas faced off against a very familiar opponent in the title game, the Villanova Wildcats. Now, Georgetown, of course, was led by John Thompson, and at center was the force known as Patrick Ewing, who was playing his final collegiate game before going to the NBA. That Final Four was the first one to feature three teams from the Big East: Georgetown, Villanova, and the Lou Cornaseca coached St. John's, led by guard Mark Jackson and forward Chris Mullin. Yet the 1985 Final Four would always be remembered for the championship game and the quote-unquote perfect game by the Wildcats, winning their first ever national championship. College basketball analysts stated before the game that in order for the Raleigh-Massimino coached Wildcats to beat Georgetown, they would have to play a perfect game. And they did. One of the most improbable upsets in the history of college basketball, the Wildcats went 22 of 28 from the field, including missing only one shot in the second half. Hence the name, The Perfect Game. Villanova's 66-64 win over Georgetown became one of the most famous games in the history of March Madness and really put the tournament on the map. Dateline, Seattle. In the last memorable championship game of college basketball that happened this week in sports history occurred in the Kingdome in 1989. And over the years, I feel that it has become one of the most overlooked thrilling national championship games ever. It was a final. In the final, there was a surprise entry by Seton Hall, coached by PJ Carlissimo and led by center Ramon Ramos and Australian forward Andrew Gaze. But Michigan was the headline of the tournament, even before the tournament action even started. When Wolverine coach Bill Frieder was fired just before the tournament started, when it was revealed that he had taken a job to become the new head coach at Arizona State, Michigan athletic director Bo Schembechler, yes, that Bo Schembechler, said, quote, he wanted a Michigan man to coach Michigan, unquote. In stepped interim head coach Steve Fisher. And as the tournament began, Michigan caught fire, and led by future NBA stars Glenn Rice, Ramir Robinson, and Loy Vaught, the Wolverines reached the Final Four at the Kingdome. In the national semifinal, Michigan defeated Big Ten rival Illinois 83-81, setting up the national title game against the Pirates of Seton Hall. In the national championship game, Michigan enjoyed a 37-32 lead at the half just 20 minutes away from the school's first ever NCAA title. Yet the second half belonged to Seton Hall and Pirate point guard John Martin, who kept Seton Hall in the game and finished with a game-high 35 points, forcing overtime. In the extra session, Martin continued his hot shooting, giving the Pirates a 3-point 79-76 lead with less than a minute remaining. Then, a clutch 11-foot jump shot by Michigan's Terry Mills cut Seton Hall's lead to 79-78. Then, Ramir Robinson was fouled with 3 seconds remaining in the extra session. Robinson coolly hit the pair of free throws to give Michigan a 1-point lead. The Pirates' last-second shot to win it fell short, and Steve Fisher, an interim head coach, led Michigan to his first-ever national championship. Glenn Rice was named tournament MVP with 34 points in the win. Moving on to other legendary events in sports history that happened this weekend. In the world of heavyweight boxing, This week marks the anniversaries of a pair of fights that are considered two of the biggest upsets in boxing's long and illustrious history. The first one that we're going to talk about took place this week 110 years ago, and it ended one of the most historic and equally controversial title holders in history. Dateline, Havana, Cuba. On April 5th, 1915, a large crowd was on hand at the Oriental Park Racetrack in Havana, Cuba, to see Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight champion, to face challenger Jess Willard for the heavyweight title. And ever since Johnson had defeated Jim Jeffries for the title in 1910, there had been an outcry by the white sporting public that the rightful champion of the heavyweight division shouldn't be in the hands of a black man. So, for the next 5 years, Johnson had defeated all white opponents that had challenged him for the title, until this fateful day in Cuba. Willard, who stood 6'6", proved to be a much more difficult opponent for Johnson. Willard, he was a classic counterpuncher, making Johnson do all the leading and would counterpunch when he saw opening in Johnson's defense. The fight lasted for 26 rounds in the stifling heat and humidity of Cuba in April. In that round, Johnson was hit with a right hand which landed him on the canvas, and then, after the count of 10, Willard had won one of the biggest upsets in boxing history, earning the heavyweight title. Now, nearly 60 years later, there will be another upset in the heavyweight ranks that caused ripple effects in the division no one thought possible. Dateline, San Diego, California. On March 31st, 1973, at the San Diego Sports Arena, Muhammad Ali, looking to retain the heavyweight title 2 years after losing to Joe Frazier in the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden, faced Ken Norton, the number 6 ranked contender in the heavyweight division. Norton came into the fight with a 21-1 record as a professional with 23 wins by knockout. The fight was carried live on ABC on Wide World of Sports on this particular spring Saturday afternoon. Ali came in with a record of 41-1 and took Norton a little bit too lightly, he said after the fight, as Norton outmaneuvered Ali and claimed a shocking 15-round split decision over the former champion. Norton landed 233 punches to Ali's 171, and all of those punches took its toll on the former champion as he suffered a fractured jaw in the fight. Ali was quoted afterwards saying, quote, "I have nobody to blame but myself for my loss to Ken Norton. I didn't train properly because I really didn't think Ken was that great of a fighter. I was wrong. This time things will be different. You see the real Muhammad Ali." Unquote. A year later, Ali would get his revenge, beating Norton in a split decision later in November. So this concludes this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, This Week in Sports History. Thanks everyone for listening, and please remember to subscribe to the show and also check us out on Twitter, X, Blue Sky, Threads, and Instagram. Also, you can contact the show at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. This show, of course, comes to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. Please, once again, don't forget to subscribe to the show. And also, please, please, please tell your family about us. Tell your friends. Tell your coworkers. Tell your neighbors. Hell, tell a passerby on the street if you think they like sports history. And until next time, please not only be good to each other, but also be the best in everything that you do. It will make the world a much, much better place. Thank you once again for joining us, and take care.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, this is Joe Ziemba, and I am the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers. And all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.